my experience as a judge on, after many years in the bench has not always been to that extent. I've even reported a psychiatrist to the medical council for unethical behavior simply because the psychiatrist spoke only to the one side and to the children involved and not to the other. And in the process gave a totally, totally skewed and unbalanced report, which I rejected. And that's why I say I regard it as so unprofessional and so unethical that, that a person who is a professional person could do that. So it may well be that a medical advisory board was totally independent advisors that it might be justified in a case like this. I know it's going to be an expense, but it doesn't have to be put into operation all the time. It may only come into use from time to time. So, and then also I agree, it shouldn't just be at the behest of the minister. It should be in every single jurisdiction. If you're going to have a medical advisory board in the Western Cape, you must have one in every other jurisdiction as well. Because otherwise you are treating people who are equal unequally. And that cannot be happening. Then, may I just make reference to the Act itself in this regard? To the bill. I've already mentioned that, as far as I'm concerned, that's where I'm in agreement with the parliamentary researcher, that legislation, particularly important legislation such as this, dealing with the question of medical parole, which has been a very controversial matter in recent times, should be succinct and very clear. And you do not want lengthy, convoluted, complicated formulations. And that's the one thing that we must avoid at all costs. So, in other words, what I would like to see is that 79.1 should, in fact, only be in 79.1A, B, and C. And I'm very happy about the appropriate arrangements in 79.1C. I'm not happy, as I mentioned in A, about the physical incapacitation. That's something new. It wasn't in the old Act, and it certainly isn't in, or in any of its predecessors, to the best of my knowledge. Why exactly the physical incapacity has come in and not any other form of incapacity? Once again, I would prefer just to look at a kind of a disability rather than incapacity, a disability which makes it impossible for a person to be able to take part in any daily activity or self-care. And self-care here in the sense that he can't help himself going to a toilet, can't help himself getting dressed, can't help himself eating, and things like that. So I think the formulation of 79.1A should be reconsidered. B is fine risk for the offence. I already mentioned the wheelchair cases. Then a medical practitioner, I think I've mentioned, should be independent in any event. And what I thought was rather strange, let me just go through those, I'll look only at 79.8, where it says 79.8, a decision to cancel medical parole. I'm not sure what cancel means. It's a strange word to be used. We're not busy with a cancellation procedure or a cancellation process. You set aside an order. If there has been a medical an order that somebody needs parole, I should imagine that the proper terminology would be set aside or retract or something to that effect, but cancel seems to be the wrong word. I think they should just give some consideration to better terminology or more clearer in that regard. place established under this Act for receptive detention, confinement, and etc., etc., all places to which some persons have been sent, and so forth. But also, I'm not sure whether it's quite clear there, that in that the process of being transferred from or transported from correctional center or a police station to a court or to wherever, during that period as well, that person is in detention, and the judicial inspector should be believed have the right at any stage to say, I want to see what's going on in this police bag. These are they were in the custody of correctional services. They are now on their way to court. I'm not satisfied, or I've been given to understand that the conditions in or the treatment of these detainees while they are being transported from place A to place B is not acceptable. And that is where I think we should also have the right to do so. How it's going to work in practice, of course, is not always so easy, because we don't have people on the spot all the time, but we do have independent visitors at every single centre in the country. And an independent visitor would then be able, on behalf of the judicial inspectorate, to request that kind of thing. I was recently in the UK and I saw that there were special arrangements for taking serious criminals, the maximum sentence criminals. Each was placed in the little compartment of his own. I know we can't always afford that kind of thing, but that should be taken into consideration in the definition of remand detention facility. You must be very careful there. In fact, a remand detainee, while I'm on that topic, a person detained in a remand detention facility until being awaiting finalization, always refer to up to now, and that is the terminology which is used almost right throughout the world, awaiting trial detainees, we always call them the ATDs. Now, we're having a new term brought in, of course, and we have to get used to it just as we have to get used to inmate, as opposed to a prisoner, or an offender, or a detainee. But it's not just until a conviction or acquittal. A person who's been convicted but not yet sentenced should also be a remand detainee, because what frequently happens is the person is convicted and then the case is postponed once again, and that person is in exactly the same position as the person who has not yet been convicted. So I don't think, for instance, in section 5, we just turn the page, where it says persons awaiting trial or so forth, remand detainees or unsentenced offenders. Now it's creating the impression that unsentenced offenders are in a category of their own. And I don't believe that is the intention. Unsentenced offenders should in fact be part and parcel of remand detainees. Incidentally, I was in Rochester, New York just about a week and a half ago and visited one of the prisons there. And they also speak of remand detainees, because I was a little concerned initially about the terminology and thought, are we not busy with an exercise in semantics? But it seems that is an acceptable term, certainly in certain states. Then, if I may just turn to section 2, which deals with the amendment of section 3 of the Principal Act. I can't recall who said it, but that the management of remand detainees is now being added. I have no idea why that's necessary, why that should be regarded as necessary. Because with subparagraph C, two subsection C says, perform all work necessary for its effective management. And that would include all kinds of detainees And since then, I've been told, no, there are magistrates who order that the person be taken back to a police cell, and that they are, in fact, kept there. Now, that person is in the same position as somebody who is referred by the magistrate to a particular centre to be incarcerated there. But now he is going to a police cell where there is no monitoring device by the judicial inspectorate, or for that matter, by any other body. And that is a totally unacceptable situation. The question that then arises is whether this subsection 2A, whether this B should not be reconsidered altogether. I think it's only under really stringent, exceptional circumstances that somebody should be retained in the police cell. And only then do I believe should it be allowed if there is a special arrangement made. I prefer that a court should make that decision. It's just a suggestion that should be reconsidered. As regards the whole question of remand detention, which is the substitution of Chapter 5 of Act 111 of 1998, I wasn't quite sure initially what was meant with in 46(3) with the provisions of Section 6025(4) applying to a remand detainee with such changes as may be required. It is so that when you interpret legislation, you look at the context in which it appears, and you read it as in that context. But that is, in other words, a contextual procedure with which you are busy, and you are not making changes. Now, what concerns me is the use of making changes, because what is that? Is it a substantive change? Is it just intended as an interpretative, or rather, an interpretation of a particular section or provision of the Act? I think something must be done about that, just to make it a little more clear what is intended by such changes as may be required. The clothing. Now, this is also something interesting. And in the Rochester prison where I was, remand detainees did have uniforms on. They had their own uniforms regardless of the period that they were there, and they were a different colour, and everybody could see that they were not convicted. And they were also given footwear, sandals, so that nobody could walk around there with very posh shoes and things like that, and create the kind of difficulty that you sometimes have where you've got people from different classes staying in the same centre. To me, it seemed to be a very positive approach to the whole thing. Once again, we must look at our own situation. We are not the USA or one of the states in the USA which might have more money than we need to deal with this kind of thing, because it is a financial aspect. But I personally think it would be a good idea. I've been to too many centres where I've seen awaiting trial detainees dressed in the so-called civilian clothing, and really looking totally out of their place. They shouldn't be there wearing that clothing, and also feeling uncomfortable, and I feel uncomfortable with them. I would prefer to see them in a uniform, and the moment they go to court, no problem, put them into their civilian clothing, which is there. But as long as they are in the centre itself, I would certainly be in favour of special clothing for them, but different from that of the convicted detainees. The other special categories, I heard what Mr. Bunting said about certain of the variations which are there, and the special provisions which are made for these. I believe that it's difficult sometimes to have special provisions in every single centre. And that is where the Department of Correctional Services may consider transferring the person from one place to another, where there are such facilities available. But I think it's generally speaking a positive approach to remand detainees to be able to give them this special attention. The release and the supervision of the South African Police Service, when I saw that, I just got shivers down my back. We've had too many cases. I'm not talking about Steve Biko. I'm talking about police taking over a person from the Department of Correctional Services for further investigation. Now, I'm not always sure what that further investigation means, but it means compelling somebody who has been arrested to take the police to a place where a crime is committed, to compel that person perhaps to plead guilty to a crime, or perhaps to build up a case which is not even prima facie at that stage. In other words, no case on which the court would even think of sustaining a conviction now is being built up. But the difficulty is even goes much further than that. When a person is in custody in a correctional centre, that person is almost in the position of a child in custody of parents. The chief of that prison, the head of that prison, is the custodian. The moment that custodian hands that particular inmate over, or detainee over to the police, it shouldn't be that now I wash my hands of this, now he's in police custody. I'm not sure that there is proper thought being given to this change in custody. Is the person no longer now in the custody of the head of centre? Seems to be no. He's now in the custody of the police. And to what extent can the police now take over what they believe is the correct procedure and particularly the investigations in regard to that particular person? So I don't like a clause like Section 49 at all. I would prefer not to see it in any legislation. But if it is there, and if it's regarded as essential, then I suggest with great respect that it should be made clear that it's only when it is justified and there are exceptional circumstances, and it must be subject to really strict conditions, because we know that there are irregularities that take place. I know, Mr. Maxis, you've been involved with the police yourself for so many years as well, and one doesn't always, you don't always have control of that situation. You, Commissioner, it would be ideal if you'd be able to control all such situations that you've got. And this is what happens in practice. So there's another thing that comes up. The moment this happens, I believe it should be in the Criminal Procedure Act. It's the kind of thing which I think provision should be made in the Criminal Procedure Act. And then the question arises, and I think Mr. Munting mentioned this, is whether or not this is not a case where you should only allow that kind of transfer from one custodian to another, should a court be satisfied that there are good and proper reasons for that. So I would support that suggestion that he's made there. We don't want to say too much about the parole. I don't think there's too much that we need to say, and I think what has been said so far, we can associate with that quite easily. Mr. Chairman, I think
another issue that comes up, and remand detainees not included in Section 5 of the Act, although it does refer to remand detention facility in Section 5 of the Act. So we have a problem with that clause, which would have to be looked at in any event. So there are challenges in that regard. Which brings me then to the definition of remand detainee and the penalty divorced from the definition of inmate. Currently, the definition of remand detainee does in fact result in three categories of persons who are detained. I'm going to call them persons who are detained. One, the category of person who is not yet convicted or acquitted. Second of all, the category of persons who have been convicted but haven't been sentenced. And then a category of sentenced defendants. Currently, this legislation creates correctional facilities for those persons who have yet been convicted. It creates correctional centers for those who have been sentenced. But there's a category that falls out of the bus here, and that is those persons who are awaiting sentence, that are convicted but awaiting sentence. So we have a problem with that definition, and I'll deal with it in more detail a little bit later. So we've created three categories in the legislation. It's problematic. To my mind, we've lost the opportunity and drafts it up very carefully of properly defining the various categories. We've got the words offender, then we've got unsentenced offender, then we've got sentenced offender, then we have inmate, then we have remand detainee. All of these different terms, whereas we should narrow it down. What is the critical definition that is required in terms of this legislation? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Grove.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
anomalies that I see here. If you look at page 5 of the book, chapter 5, 46, page 3, start there. Section 5, towards the bottom. Now, naturally, the current wording is proposed to be removed. But there is something that comes from the old act. Remand detainees or unsentenced offenders, which replaces the old words, must be provided with opportunities and facilities to prepare their defense. And if you then look at page 13 of the book, 17, and then they've got Kaka, the capital S, AKS. Visits to remand detention facilities by relatives and others of remand detainees and arrangements for a remand detainee to consult with a legal practitioner. One of the things can be done. But I've been to some of the facilities, Chairperson, in rural areas, small facilities, small towns. And I've been told by inmates that they do not have access to lawyers. They don't get any assistance to access them. My argument is that whilst on the one hand, the current act, when it says must, compels the implementer of the act, in this case the department, to allow for that kind of assistance. And it's again now in the new amendment, number 17, paragraph 17. Again, it's being re-emphasized. And the arrangement for the remand detainee to consult with the legal practitioner. That this is not in effect happening. My problem is that whilst you compel, there is no other way that the detainee has recourse. So I would like the judge to give me a feeling as to what needs to be done to see that that compulsion, if it is not carried out, there must be some form of recourse. Chairperson, you've alluded to 49F. What I would like to ask the Honourable Judge is that my understanding, and this was borne out this morning on a radio report that I was listening to while driving in, there are investigations going on in the Mpumalanga province with particular deaths, and the police chief there was asked, why have no arrests been made? The response he gave is, as you said earlier, we first investigate. And the moment we have a reasonable prima facie case, we will arrest the person. Until then, we cannot just go into the wild and start collecting people and arrest them. My problem with this entire clause, Chairperson, it's a new clause, is also what you have mentioned. That the system currently operates in a manner where you first investigate, and once you have determined that you have a case, I think you need a warrant to arrest some other authority, the judge must help me. But Chairperson, there's another anomaly here in this clause. We're not going through the clauses now, but it's just something that surprises. I haven't seen the definitions because there are no definitions in the amendment yet. There are no new definitions. I haven't looked at the whole act. 49F3 on page 7. The National Commissioner of the South African Police Service, having custody of the remand detainee, may, on good cause shown, apply to the National Commissioner for an extension of the period referred to in subsection 2. I take it that reference is made to the National Commissioner of Correctional Services, unless that is clear in the definitions, and this may have the object of being a bit of a problem in terms of interpretation. You're referring to the National Commissioner of SEPS, and then you say that he may apply to the National Commissioner. Chairperson, what I would like to know from the judge is that in practice, I mean, you know, the law has to be applied, and the law must be applied in a manner that those that apply the law are able to apply it without any contradictory problems. Is this common practice that the law should provide for this kind of a clause regarding, you know, making use of an opportunity to take a detainee for whatever purpose? Some of the purposes that I could think of, Chairperson, would be that the detainee, after a prima facie case has been prepared, and that you have discovered that you do have a prima facie case, and there may be certain things that you require the detainee to point out to you, for example, where he had hidden a firearm or something of that sort. But as far as the investigative part is concerned, I don't think you need to take the guy out. And we have seen abuses in the past, and one does not want to create a window of opportunity for a recurrence of that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Smith, I go to you. Do you want to speak on this matter, and then the judge will respond to all the input?
Yes. Chair, I'll confine my remarks just to those that have been raised. One in particular is the uniform issue. And you raise questions, but I think practice will determine whether uniforms are at all practicable in this country. Because the normal process is remand detainee will wear his clothes to the court. And should that court release the individual on bail or the case be finalized against that accused, if he's now sitting in the uniform, then he'd simply be released unless police now take the role of gathering the uniform and getting them back to DCS. So we have a practical consideration which might mitigate against uniforms. I've taken the time to be in the Johannesburg remand detention facility when they're booking out individuals. And on a Monday, you have a huge number of people coming through those facilities. Quite simply, to my mind, you don't have, first of all, the storage facilities for all the firearms clothes. You don't have changing facilities. You also have female correctional officials who are there present, so you can't just have people changing. You're going to delay the entire process, and there simply isn't enough accommodation in there. And the bus is a particular concern regarding that uniform. That's something which has to be looked at from a practical perspective. Legislatively, it may be great. One of the challenges are, we've already heard today that there are not very many detainees from correctional services and remand detention facilities. So if uniforms are intended to address that, you're spending a lot of money and we're not going to achieve very much. The other two points are important to make. That correctional officials themselves have uniforms, so they're distinct from the remand detainees who are generally in service clothes. And the second point is those sentence offenders who are working in the remand detention facility have their own uniforms. So there already is a distinction in the remand detention facility. They only address
identification parade for another matter for which the accused is not charged. An individual might be picked up for a rape offence caught in the act, but then they're suspected of a serial rapist, and now according to the legislation you can't go and book that person out for the identification parade of a number of complainants who may be complaining and say, well, the modus operandi is the same, why not have identification parades so we can point out this individual. So that's first of all one reason, and it addresses both of those challenges. Another reason might be that the accused has been out of bail on another matter and they need to take the person to court. They need to now take the accused instead of him going to Johannesburg Magistrates Court, they need to go and take him so he can go reappear in another case or on a slightly different charge in another court. So there's another reason why the person might be booked up. The accused might stay in an informal settlement where there is no way of confirming the individual's address. You need the address for purposes of bail. So the investigating officer may need to take the person, let them go and point out their particular residence. Maybe that the accused says, well, I got the stolen property from A, B, and C. The police officer would then, in course of investigation, and this evidence might, in fact, go to the accused's credit, take the accused to show who is A, B, and C, so that they can be further questioned. And it can be a totally different matter as well in that regard. In respect of investigating to detain and detain to investigate, to my suspicion that it is both. And the judge can perhaps address this in more detail. If you catch an accused committing a crime, it is necessary for the police to arrest that person and not say, well, I simply won't arrest you, I've got to go and investigate the matter first. You've got to, in fact, effect an arrest and then investigate the matter while the accused is detained in custody. Obviously, if it's not a high-risk shoplifting, whatever other things there may be, or allegations, in those circumstances, there may be good reason why you wouldn't arrest, you do first complete the investigation, then arrest that suspect. If the suspect is a flightless, a serious offence, surely the person must be arrested and then the investigation would generally follow. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I've been from all sides. Maybe I should just deal with this last aspect that's relating to the reasons for surrendering the detainee to the South African police. I have no difficulty with the question of an ID parade. I would have great difficulty with any of the other examples that Mr. Smith has alluded to. But it is quite correct. 49F1 says clearly that he may not be surrendered to this SAP for the purposes of further investigation into charges other than those for which he or she has been detained. In other words, it does presuppose that this is not for investigation in his own case, but for investigation of another. I don't know whether I'm misreading this, but that seems to be what it says. For the purpose of investigation, further investigation into charges other than those charges for which he was previously had. So it could be a case which is linked to his case, or it could be a case which is not linked at all. And that under those circumstances, but still justifiable reasons must be given for removing the person from one custodial situation to another. And that is where the problems can arise. I do not agree, Mr. Smith, with the suggestion that you can arrest a person and then investigate as it is. You can only arrest a person in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, as I understand it, if you have good reason for it. If there are justifiable reasons for you to arrest a person. Quite clearly, if you catch him in the middle of a crime, committing the crime, you catch him while he's busy breaking into a house or into a building. Of course, you've got all the prima facie evidence you need right there and then. One witness to say, I saw him break in. Maybe that's all you need for a conviction. But to say, I'm going to commence an investigation after I've right to freedom. You are arresting a person breaching that right on the basis that you may or may not at some future time have sufficient evidence against you. You can only arrest a person if you believe you have a sufficient, sustainable evidence for purposes of a conviction. Relating to the process of a uniform, to me, it's not a kind of question which even has to be dealt with by this legislation. If you are satisfied that when they are incarcerated as awaiting trial detainees or as remand detainees, should wear a uniform, simply because you want to have them all on an equal basis in the sense that they look the same and that you don't have any kind of unhappiness. I've had situations where people have come in as arrestees, been detained in a prison, but they look as if they've just come out of a very top class men's shop, where they're wearing absolutely state of the art kind of thing, and they are immediately a target. And in fact, it was the one case, one prison that we visited, last year, where there was where four young men came in. They had just been arrested for robbery or something like that, armed robbery or a vehicle robbery in Johannesburg. They were brought to this prison, and that was from Rainsburg, and they were immediately, just after being there, assaulted most severely by these people, and their clothing and their shoes and stuff had been taken off them. So it would appear that that would be a very good reason to put them into a uniform the moment they arrive and put away their clothing, as you're supposed to do with all their valuables, and you won't have that kind of problem. I would have no objection to that taking into court in that uniform either, if it's going to be a question of a procedure which runs smoothly. Because your public is going to get used to the fact that people who wear that kind of uniform are not convicted people, but they are being detained. As opposed to people who are not being detained and who are out on their own recognizance or who have received bail. People who are on bail don't have to come in that kind of clothing. So that's the kind of situation. I don't know whether that answers your question, but you did also ask me another question, but I'll get to that now. Madam Duenya, yes, thank you very much for the support that you have. It's important for us to be able to understand one another and to understand. I think we're all in the same thing eventually. We all want justice to be done and we want it all to be seen to be done. Mr. Bunting, the 49F, will the police bring an accused back, make sure that he gets back to court? Well, I suppose that's just one of the examples that you can give of a problem which may arise. One doesn't know, because one would expect that if the National Commissioner allows a person to be removed on good cause shown, then it would always be subject there to that the South African Police Commissioner must make sure that this person is back in court at the relevant time. Otherwise, I believe that the commissioner, the police commissioner, would probably be exposing himself to very serious consequences. So I don't think that in practice that is going to be a particular problem. What does bother me is what happens when he or she is in police custody. We've heard cases, and I know this happens in the USA also. I see it on a regular basis in correspondence and in certain other documentation. If it's a woman, is she going to be raped? If it's a man, is he going to be sodomized, etc.? Is there going to be an assault? Is some kind of torture going to be affected? Because you have no control of that. And that's why it's essential for the judicial inspectorate to be told about these cases, and then also to be able to have the power to have somebody in the vicinity, perhaps not there on the spot, but in the vicinity to assist, should it be necessary. That may be one of the functions of monitoring which could be expanded to a certain degree. We would be happy to do that. I certainly would be happy to make sure for what happens in that transit period. We can't have an independent visitor sitting with those people in every single case where detainees are being transferred from the court, from the correctional centre to the courts. But the police should be accountable if anything happens to them. There are cases, and in fact, we have raised that when a person comes back from court and he gets out of that vehicle, that police vehicle, and he has been severely assaulted, we immediately follow that up, and we insist that the commissioner investigate the situation, and that now we're talking about not the police commissioner, but the National Commissioner of Correctional Services, and then decide whether or not charges should be laid against whomsoever for allowing such a situation to take place. Mr. South, the cancellation, you know, I think that's also, it might be a question of a rather a review perhaps of the order. I think you mentioned the review question, not so much as part of the use of the word cancellation for cancelling a medical parole. The whole question arises whether, if it should appear that the parole has been granted irregularly or wrongly, whether there should be a right to review that. Now, from the 1st of October last year, the inspecting judge has had the right to refer any matter of that nature, and the Sharia Sheikh would have been before me, and you can rest assured, had that act already come into operation, on the 1st of April. I think he was paroled sometime in April. But it only happened 6 months later, so we had no power. Certainly for the future, we can do nothing about what's happened in the past. There's no way in which we can review that. We don't have that authority, and Judge Desai also mentioned at that stage that he was the relevant authority, that he couldn't review it either. But now, the judicial inspectorate does have the right of review. And you may rest assured that a case like this will certainly be referred to review if it is justifiable, or if there is a good reason to suspect that the parole has been granted wrongly or irregularly. Yes, we have the right, we have the right to refer to the review, to the parole review board. That's what I mean there, in terms of the acts. Yes, I think I've already dealt with the question of the three cases in transit, the three cases with South African police are. Should the judicial inspectorate be empowered to look after these people? Of course I believe so. While they're in transit, if I want to know what's happening in that police van, and I should be able to stop it and say I want to see what's going on in the van. Because I've had cases where two police officers are sitting in a van, one is a driver, the other is a passenger. They hear that there's a serious assault taking place in the van, and they do nothing about it. I want those people, if there's a death that ensues, and we've had a case where a death that ensued, that in a case like that, a culpable homicide charge should be filed. Certainly, if we establish that, a charge will be filed. And that's the kind of thing we're looking at. As far as that's concerned, also, when that person is in his court cell or in a police cell, I want to have access at any stage to that person to establish what are the conditions under which he's kept. Does he have a toilet facility? Does he get food, etc., etc.? And how is he being treated? Okay. Mr. Swift yourself, the section 79.2C, the medical report. I agree with you. Initially, I would say anything from 2 to 8 should be in the form of regulation, but it is true. There are aspects there which I believe are purely regulatory, but there are aspects which perhaps do justify being part of the Act. valid humans have both basic rights, which must also be respected, and they are not always respected under those circumstances. Mr. Abram, you mentioned an anomaly in section 5 at page 3. Remand detainee or unsentenced offenders must be provided with opportunities and facilities to prepare their defense. You know what's interesting there is preparing defense is what you do before you're convicted. And that is an anomaly. Because if you are an unsentenced offender, it means you might already have been convicted. And you don't prepare a defense when you are convicted but not yet sentenced. So that must be reconsidered altogether. An unsentenced person must have the opportunity to prepare mitigation, to prepare evidence on sentence, which has got nothing to do with a defense. So I think that should be reconsidered. As far as section 17 of page 13 is concerned, let me just take it. Yes, that's the amendment of section 134 of the Act relating